Campus FM presents My Pizza and Toffee Apples in the 1950s. Produced and presented by Patricia Salomone.
In the long, quiet evenings before the advent of television, my father listened to the BBC News and my mother played Chopin on our piano. Her music drifted out through the open windows into the dark summer nights, lit up only here and there by the dim lights in the British military barracks opposite our home. As children, we were always encouraged to read, and I must say that it did become my hobby. From the school library, I borrowed a book by Anna Sewell, Black Beauty. The beautiful horse and its companions, Duchess, Rob Roy, Lizzie, Merrylegs, became my companions. I fell in love with horses, and having little chance of meeting any, I never missed the opportunity of running downstairs to caress the big black horse that drew the green paraffin tank when the hawker, Dal Petrolio, came twice weekly. Influenced by Sewell's sentiment for those animals, and aware of Modugno's sad hymn to the blind horse, Cavaddu Cicu della Miniera,
Cavaddu, cavaddu cicu della miniera.
I felt sorry for the patient creature having to pull so much weight and standing out in the cold, windy winter weather. I begged the hawker not to use his whip, and I spoke to the animal, believing that it understood the kind words I whispered to it in English.
Cavaddu, cavaddu cicu della miniera.
I looked straight into its eyes and wondered if it understood my feelings for it. While around us, the women chatted, holding on to their cans, and waited for their turn to purchase the precious petrolio, to warm up their homes, to boil the kettle, and even do the cooking on the old-fashioned stoves. In the earlier days, paraffin also served to fuel our refrigerators. And that was quite a leap forward to placing water in pottery jars to keep it cool. It was while I stood by that horse that many a time I saw an old Englishman who walked along, his shaggy hands leaning on the handlebar of his bicycle. He wore an old army uniform under a dirty, tattered, khaki coat. His head was covered by an Air Force pilot's leather cap with flaps over his ears. He muttered to himself as he shuffled along the road with wild red eyes and a bewildered look on his face. The kids feared him, and the grown-ups whispered that he had been shell-shocked. Nobody explained what that meant. To us, it meant that the shell-shocked man was a bad man, frightening because he was different, and because he was different, he was to be kept at arm's length. Some of the kids followed him, mocking and calling him names. Yet, if only for pity's sake, the adults had explained, we would have known better. We would, perhaps, have understood.
If you could hear at every jolt The blood come gargling from the froth corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children, ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie. Dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori.
But, coming back to horses, another horse, or maybe it was a donkey, pulled a more attractive contraption. This was the musical carousel that sometimes went down Dragut Street on Sundays. When we heard it, we all came out on our balconies and threw 3-penny coins to the owner, who picked the coins in his cap and stopped to let his pianola run while the music blurted out old-fashioned tunes, and the wooden statuettes in multicolored clothes turned round and round and round until the man resumed his walk and disappeared round the corner, the music fading away in the distance. Other times, a dreary procession came down the road. Walking in twos and wearing their dull grey uniform came the boys from St. Patrick's, their heads shaven and led by a black-dressed Salesian father. I felt sad for those boys who had no mum at home warming up the kettle on the Aladdin heater to make a hot cup of tea for them, as we had. Summer, the Wembley ice cream man pushed the cart downhill, calling out, "Ice cream! Ice cream! Wembley ice cream!" Inevitably, the nagging would begin, until parents gave in and we raced down the stairs from MacIver Flats, from Caledonia Mansions and all the other apartment blocks with British names to purchase those white and pink delicacies in little cups or sandwiched between two wafers. Another visitor who regularly came down the road was an Irish nun who belonged to the congregation of the Little Sisters of the Poor. She was a tall, good-looking woman, with kindly eyes and rosy cheeks. She always brought along a sister from her congregation. With utmost dignity, they knocked on doors and rang all the bells of the apartment blocks, begging on behalf of their poor. Of these there were many in those days, and many, many were the poor who chose emigration, encouraged by governments which were unable to provide them with a better solution. But we, We were children, and thankfully unaware of the problems around us. We looked forward to Thursday, as this was our day off school. If we were good girls and had done all our homework, she would dress us up. White lace gloves in the warm season, warm gloves and scarves in the winter, and take us to Valletta, the old Baroque city. I had mixed feelings for those trips to town. Invariably, I became carsick on our rickety buses, and by the time we got to Valletta, I looked like a sick ghost, and it took all her patience to cheer me up and help me walk the first few steps until the fresh air gave me back my rosy cheeks, and she could show off her bambine. We would stop at 20 Kingsway to meet our daddy, who seemed embarrassed and quite harassed by our visit, as he always was, very busy. Undaunted, she would take us to Café Cordina, where we would be given the treat of a delicious pastry. At Christmas time, we would visit the Bethlehem Bazaar in Merchant Street to purchase little statuettes for the Christmas crib. Every year, a couple more, until the crib became absolutely overcrowded. Daniela would always choose the little white lambs. Never in those childhood days would she have guessed that she would spend her adult life living quite close to the real town of Bethlehem. In our very younger years, during our visits to the majestic Baroque city, she would take us to visit her friend Vera in the old palazzo in St. Paul's Street. Two little girls, brought up in four simple rooms in an apartment block in Quiz. This dwelling place was a medieval castle. The palazzo door was adorned with a heavy brass knocker, and the doorbell was not the press button we knew, but it consisted of a metal handle which we had to pull very, very hard. It then rang and echoed through the big house until, after quite awake, the rosy-cheeked, smiling owner would come down and open. She kissed and hugged our mum and let us in through the massive wooden door, into the empty hallway, which resounded with our voices and footsteps. The cased stairs led up three floors, but they also led down into a green labyrinth of aging mould. Curiosity pulled our little legs along the musty green walls down the circular marble staircase. Our hearts beat faster as we went down, down, down towards the unknown. Never, I must admit, did we have the courage to go to the very bottom of the labyrinth. The green musty walls, the broken furniture and the cobwebbed furnishings had us trembling with fear, So we ran up, away from the nightly ghosts and shadows, towards the upper floors, where the sun shone through the large, curtainless windows, white, a blinding white light. Up we ran towards Vera's kitchen, where tomato sauce was always in the making, and a plate of cooked spaghetti would be waiting to whet the appetite. There was an enormous refrigerator, the only modern amenity in that grand old home. I learned later that the family were the first to import such luxuries to the island. To a small child, those rooms were enormous, and the sparse furniture in most made them seem even larger. They sounded hollow, and our voices echoed over and over and over. On the piano nobile, there was a very grand room, the one that boasted a big Maltese galleria. I remember it held priceless treasures strewn about the floor. There were gold-gilt mirrors standing awkwardly against the wall. Worn Victorian sofas exposed their horsehair interiors like wounded horses, spilling out their entrails. A big buhl writing table, richly adorned with mother-of-pearl and ivory designs, stood forlorn in a corner. We were told it had been the table at which Napoleon Bonaparte had signed the ceding of Malta to Lord Nelson. Sundry boxes of bric-a-brac spilled out their wares, whilst the damask curtains hung loosely off the gold-gilt sopraporta at the two windows flanking the galleria. To the young mistress of the house, all this felt alien. Oh, she pined for her modest home back in Posillipo, its crowded alleys, its loud voices, the music and the smells. To my childish eyes, to my young girl's imagination, this was a palace, the home which a princess should have brought back to sparkling life. I imagined the crystal chandeliers shining brightly with hundreds of light bulbs, the red quilted sofas splendid in their majesty, and the hall teeming with elegant ladies in evening dress being courted by handsome young men in uniform. The lady of the house did not care, and she lived simply in her bright kitchen with the enormous refrigerator and the bedroom in which there was a big double bed, a baby's cot, and simple bedside tables. The baby in the cot was beautiful. It was a little boy, blonde, pink, and plump, as was his older brother who played with us. Our common language was Italian, as was our mother's. We had plenty of time to play, because they had plenty to talk about as they sat at the large table in the big white kitchen high on the top floor of a large Valletta house from which you could see the magnificent Grand Harbour, crowded with the vessels of the British Navy, flying the Union Jack.
Timide le viole mammole, ormai la prima rondine è tornata, nel cielo limpido comincia a volteggiare, il tempo bello viene ad annunciare, a aprite le finestre al nuovo sole.
Autumn Thursdays sometimes also meant a visit to Villa Eugenie. Now that was really something different. A visit into the past, which we treasured. We left our little home early in the afternoon to take two buses for a ride which seemed forever to the big green gate which opened onto the pathway up the hill to Villa Eugenie in Birkirkara.
Aprite le finestre al nuovo sole, è primavera, festa dell'amore. La 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 la. Aprite le finestre al nuovo sole.
Then we would see her there, tiny little Aunt Eugenie. Ah, bonjour les enfants, she would say in French. She had little silver teeth, and all about her was tiny and fine. Her hands, her white chignon, even her voice was tiny. She conversed politely with our mother, in a mixture of French and Italian. And again, as in Palazzo d'Ayala back in Taranto, we were told to be on our best behaviour. Sometimes, with her little hands, she played the piano while we listened until it was time for tea. Up on antique chairs, our feet barely touching the floor, we balanced the fine-boned china teacups in our trembling hands under our mother's apprehensive eyes, while Aunt Eugenie served courabier, because somehow, although she spoke French, she was Greek. We sat beside the silk partition on which a huge Indian tiger was embroidered. I would give anything to see that tiger again. I loved running my fingers along its shiny side. Its eyes had a piercing look, and I dreamt of it at night when we got home after our visit to Villa Eugenie. After tea, while the ladies continued their polite conversation, we were allowed to run out into the garden, but forbidden to pick the oranges off the trees. Of course, nothing was sweeter than managing to steal a couple of oranges. And oh, the disappointment when we picked the largest, only to find out that they were bitter oranges, of the kind our Nanna used to make her jars of marmalade. Eugenie had a husband. He had a jolly face with a moustache, and he always wore a bow tie. They had two handsome grown-up sons, two smart gentlemen, who I seem to remember wearing a uniform. Aunt Eugenie spoke of her sons as les garçons, which left me quite perplexed, as I thought garçons were boys, whilst to my eyes these were, in fact they were, two grown-up men. Beneath the house was a small shed which housed a treasure, Les Garçons' metal toy jeep. I thought it was quite strange that two grown-up garçons would play with a toy jeep. But in hind thought, that must have been a childhood toy which they had never disposed of, and which, to us children visiting, was a perfect toy. Thank you. Aunt Eugenie is long gone, and the beautiful villa has fallen victim of our building speculators. All that remains are some of the old orange trees, the old green gate, and that name, Villa Eugenie. But the new inhabitants of the apartments that have risen on that corner of my past do not know who the lady was, and they hardly even pronounce that fine little old lady's fine little old-fashioned name. As I talk about them, the characters from my childhood, relatives, friends, neighbours, I realise their memory remains ingrained forever. How true it is that the older you get, the more vivid are the memories of the past. I have more to tell you about next week. Please join me. Until then, goodbye.